Welcome to Unfiltered. I'm SE Cup. Here's tonight's headline: panic attack. The coronavirus has unleashed a wave of panic across the country, evidenced by runs on hand sanitizer and face masks, cancellations of major events, schools, and transportation closures, and quarantines in a handful of states. There are two crucial weapons in the fight to stop an outbreak: science and information. Now, I'm not a scientist. If you're also not a scientist, you're left to rely on information passed along from scientists to the government and then to the public, you and me. But that information has been slow to come, complicated, and in some cases even compromised, resulting in, well, panic. That's not because we don't have good scientists. It's mostly because we don't trust our government. Public trust in government is at historic lows, and President Trump isn't helping. He has made, according to fact checkers, more than 14,000 false or misleading claims since his inauguration. We told you his lies would matter, even as his supporters shrugged them off as just, you know, Trump being Trump. Nowhere are the lies more consequential than during a major health crisis. To wit, the president claimed he had a hunch that the World Health Organization is wrong about the death rate from coronavirus. He has undermined the severity of the outbreak by claiming Democrats are just trying to hurt him politically. He has used the health crisis to advocate for his anti-immigration policy. He has contradicted his own scientists and experts in real time. During a serious visit to the CDC, he cracked a joke about his Ukraine phone call being more perfect than coronavirus tests. He riffed on TV ratings. He stoked a feud with the governor of the state at the epicenter of the U.S. outbreak. And there was this.
And we've now shipped out, I think it was enough to test 75,000 people into the public health labs now.
Anybody that wants a test can get a test. That's what
I would just say that we.
So is it 75,000 people who can get tested, or is it everybody? A quarantine nurse says she was refused a test, even though she'd been exposed to the virus. If you're confused, well, here was White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway on Friday to clear things up.
What I am pleased to report is that the 14 deaths so far that are completely tragic and very sad in this country shows that this has been contained because the president took action, and a lot of you criticized him for doing that.
This is false. The outbreak is not contained. Since Kellyanne made this false claim, nearly 200 coronavirus cases have been added to the national tally, bringing the total number of cases in the U.S. to at least 406 across 29 states. Here's the deal. This is why we're panicked. We don't know who to believe. We don't believe the commander-in-chief. And at the worst possible time. In the U.S. alone, the flu is responsible for 18,000 deaths this season, according to the CDC. Coronavirus, 17. And yet we're stocking our pantries with toilet paper and bottled water. We're paying as much as $350 for a two-pack of Purell. We're canceling our travel. Austin's massive South by Southwest festival, canceled. University of Washington is doing online classes only. NBA teams may play games in empty arenas. Acela suspended three express trains between New York and D.C. All of this is probably over an abundance of caution. That's good. But it's also pretty clear a response to a government that we don't trust, led by a president we don't believe. That lack of trust cuts both ways. Here was one Trump supporter saying she doesn't believe coronavirus is real.
So you don't believe coronavirus exists?
I don't.
So the two people who've been reported to have died from it in Washington state, you don't trust that that's true?
I don't trust anything the Democrats do or say.
What are the odds she's washing her hands for a full 20 seconds? This lack of trust is worse than bad. It's dangerous, as New York Governor Andrew Cuomo put it.
We have an epidemic caused by coronavirus, but we have a pandemic that is caused by fear. Now, what causes fear? Only two things. People get afraid when either they think they don't have the right information or they don't trust the information they're getting, or the information they're getting is so frightening that they have the normal reaction.
Joining me to discuss is Ann Kurth, Dean of Yale School of Nursing and professor at the Yale School of Public Health. Dr. Kurth, let me just ask you, is this supposed to be going better?
We have a lot of lessons learned, Essie, from pandemics in the past. So we've been here before. Mm. The scale of the and impact of, on the economy is probably somewhat unprecedented, but we do know the basic principles, and your point is really crucial. This is no time for politics or partisanship. We have to have fact-based science that's led by people who know what they're doing, which is your public health and your healthcare workers on the ground.
Yeah, so how important is managing the flow of information to controlling and containing an outbreak? What is the link between that information getting out, it being accurate and going to the right people, and actually containing this outbreak?
Right. And so, again, with a brand new pathogen, we will be learning more as time goes on. That has to be said. It is a dynamic unfolding events. And so we will learn more as we go, and it really will know the most in retrospect. That said, we know there are some basic common sense principles, and these are things that your mother told you. Mm. Wash your hands, right? Cough into your
elbow.
Social distancing of 6 feet if you think someone is coughing or sneezing. These are fundamental principles that anyone can enact, so we're not disempowered. I would also say turn off Twitter, go to the CDC website, and go with information that you can trust, and that will have to be science-based.
Can we trust what the president is saying?
I don't think we need to turn to the president to understand what we should be doing on the ground in our locales. We should be working with our city, state, and local health departments and our health systems, and that is unrolling as we go forward.
Nurses have expressed their frustration that they're not getting accurate information. They're not getting testing or treatment either. If they're not getting the information they want, how do we know in the general public that we're getting the information?
So there was a survey done by a national nursing organization that did assess whether nurses were hearing from their hospitals, is there a preparedness plan, do we have the protocols, do we have the protective equipment, and not every hospital had that to the level that it should have. And frankly, there's no excuse for that. Health workers are on the front line. They need the protective equipment, they need the testing, they need the protocols, and they need to be protected if they are exposed and have to be treated. And so we have to maintain the rights of everyone, particularly our frontline workers. Nurses are the frontline.
Yeah.
There are 4 million of us in the United States, and we are the most trusted profession in the country. So we can leverage that trust. We are here for patients.
Dr. Ann Kurth, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now I want to bring in former DNC chair and former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. Governor, it's individual states that are really feeling the stress of this coronavirus crisis. As a former governor, what would you be telling the people of your state in the middle of all of this chaos and misinformation coming from the top of government?
And Essie, that's the problem, because for the governors, we have to rely in a pandemic like this on the federal government to provide us information.
Right.
And then we get it out to all of our cities and counties. Right now, you're not getting anything out of the Trump administration. And what you are getting out are facts that are just plain wrong. I mean, he has lied to us. We have a compulsive liar in the White House dealing with this very serious crisis. He said everybody who wants to be tested can be tested. We know that's not true. He says it's been contained. It hasn't been contained. But, you know, this is a history with this Trump administration. I dealt with this administration through immigration policy on ICE detainers. I dealt with the president in Charlottesville when I told him he needed to come out and condemn hatred, and he came out and said there were good people on both sides. Donald Trump looks at everything, not for the health and safety of the people who live in this country, which is your job, and it's a governor's job to keep people safe. He looks at it through a prism of how do I win re-election? And I hate to say this, and I hope it's not true, but is he deliberately holding down the numbers? He won't let the people off the cruise ship because he doesn't want the numbers to go up. Are people not being tested because he doesn't want it to affect the economy, affect the stock market, which is the only thing he can run on and talk at least about running on? And that's what's disconcerting. We need information at the state level to make our own decisions. We're passing budgets.
Yeah, people wondered the same when it came to the reporting of deaths after Puerto Rican hurricanes, too.
Right.
We also remember Donald Trump drawing, you know, on a weather map to make one of his, you know, forecasts true. The you know, we can talk partisan politics all we want, but his, distortion of facts and science is dangerous in a time like this. But I want to know from you, Governor, how can we restore our faith in government? I mean, as you just saw, it's not just us distrusting Trump. His supporters don't trust Democrats. Democrats don't trust Republicans. Most of us don't trust government. It feels like we're broken.
Well, because I think we've gone through several years now, and SCU, you mentioned some of these, a president who just, he's thousands and thousands of lies. They've all been categorized about the number of lies he had. So people don't have faith in their elected officials anymore because the president of the United States of America cannot tell the truth. And so people just don't pay attention anymore. This is a crisis that we all need to be paying attention to. It's going to have severe ramifications. We are at the beginning of this. We are not in the middle or at the end. And you look to your president to be that moral leader. We want someone to stand up in a moment of crisis and give us direction and help us. But practically at the state level, our information all comes from the federal government that we then relay to our cities and counties and our health officials. Without that information, we're flying in the blind. We need all of us, 50 states, working together and come together with a comprehensive plan. And this is the sad thing about the Trump administration. But it's been example after example. But this is the most serious, where the president is putting Americans' health at risk. He is compulsively lying about the test kits, about the number of people who have been infected. It has not been contained. And it is really, it's sad for this country. We should be a leader. I mean, look at 140,000 people have been tested in South Korea.
Right.
Other nations are able to do this. We are the greatest nation on earth, and we can't do it because we have a president who is deliberately trying to hold things down because he doesn't want people to be affected as it relates to the economy. And if he doesn't have a strong economy, Donald Trump has zero chance of winning re-election.
Do you think that Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden should cancel big campaign events and rallies in light of this health crisis?
I think they should look at it. They've got to make their own decisions. I don't want people to panic. I think people have to be smart about going about their everyday lives. I mean, conferences are all being canceled. I just talked to my son, who was on a flight from San Diego to San Francisco. There were 10 people on the plane.
Yeah.
I mean, people are making those precautions for themselves. But you know, we got to go about on our lives. We got to continue. We got to continue to do what we're doing every day as Americans. But we got to make smart decisions about it. And if you don't have to go to huge rallies, maybe you shouldn't go. But, you know, we still got to continue on. We are America. We are strong when we're united together. But please, let's get some leadership out of the federal government from the Trump administration so we can start making some smart decisions. The president should be giving us a path.
Yeah.
He's not giving us a path.
If you do go attend a rally, take a listen to what Dr. Kurth and your mom says. Wash your hands, cough into your elbow, and try not to touch anyone if you don't have to. Yeah. All right, Governor, good to see you.
I got Perel in my pocket right now, Essie.
Oh, me too. Me too.
Yeah, very good.
I am armed. All right.
Thank you.
And then there were another big primary day looms. Will Sanders see his fortunes change, or will the so-called establishment put Biden over the top? That answer could come down to one pivotal state. I'll talk to the former governor of Michigan for her insight. That's all coming up. And then there were two. Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are gearing up for another crucial primary day. Six states will vote on Tuesday. After Biden's Super Tuesday comeback, Sanders desperately needs to have a good night. So in Michigan last night, he attacked Joe Biden's record on everything from foreign policy to trade.
Joe Biden and I have very, very strong differences in terms of our record and in terms of what we believe to be the case. NAFTA was not a success. Voting for it was a big, big mistake.
Both Sanders and Biden are honing their messaging against each other. For Biden, he's making the point that Sanders will divide the Democratic Party and hand Trump the election. For Sanders, he's making the point that Biden is the establishment, and the establishment doesn't work for all Americans.
Joe is running a campaign which is obviously heavily supported by the corporate establishment. At last count, he has received funding from at least 60 billionaires.
The establishment are all those hard-working, middle-class people, those African Americans, those single women.
So which message will resonate with more voters? Well, Biden's Super Tuesday wins this week expose something about the Sanders campaign. It has no clothes. If this election is rigged for Biden, it wasn't rigged very well. Biden was basically broke going into Super Tuesday. He barely campaigned in some of the states he won, states like Massachusetts, Maine, and Texas. Biden won all kinds of voters in all kinds of places. He won urban voters, upscale and middle-class suburban voters, and rural Appalachian voters. Are they the establishment? Are they proof of election rigging? The inconvenient truth for Sanders seems to be that the establishment isn't standing in his way. Voters are. Okay, now let me bring in Democratic Congressman from Wisconsin and co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Mark Pocan, who has endorsed Sanders. Congressman, Sanders himself said this week there's a massive effort to stop Bernie Sanders. Explain to me what that massive effort is.
Well, I think we just saw. I mean, Joe Biden had a great week, but it's the first great week he's had in a year. And certainly a lot of things happened with people dropping out of the race before Super Tuesday, endorsing him all on the same day. There was a great orchestration that occurred that helped lift Joe Biden. But now, like a basketball bracket, we're down to the finals. We have the final two candidates. Yeah. And now the distinction is very clear, right? We have a moderate, more establishment candidate. You have a progressive, more populist candidate. And now let's really talk about those issues, because I think those issues really matter, especially in trying to drive out votes in places like Wisconsin that are a must-win looking at November.
But isn't, I mean, the endorsements and, you know, isn't this just like campaigning? I mean, Sanders has huge name ID. He ran for president before. He's got a sophisticated ground game and devoted followers. He was the front runner for a while. All the makings of a solid campaign. Is it possible he's just not a national candidate?
Well, and it still is a solid campaign. They're basically within not that many delegates different from each other, because we still haven't counted all the California votes. So there's still a lot to come. I think what we're seeing, though, is there are a lot of people, and I can tell you this from now serving 7 years in Washington, D.C. There is a political class, and I think this is what the real problem is, that don't really see the urgency for change like people in Wisconsin and many places in the country do. People make six or seven figures, and they have health insurance, and they don't have the same worries that people in my district and the other places I've campaigned have. Let's face it, if there wasn't a political establishment or a political class, we would have cheaper drug prices in this country. But there are 1,500-plus lobbyists in Washington, D.C. for Big Pharma, and that's why we pay 10 times more for insulin here than we do in Canada. So that part is true. The thing that we have to do is make sure that we're fighting against that part so that we can get cheaper drug prices and get access for health care for every single person, and not spend time in needless wars where all too often people in places like Wisconsin and across the country can lose a son or daughter, or that son or daughter can lose a limb or lose their family from being gone for so long. So those issues are very real, but maybe not for some people who like to talk about it a lot inside the Beltway.
Well, and as you're saying, Sanders really likes to rail against the establishment. For all the reasons you just laid out, is it possible, though, that after 4 years of Trump, people are actually kind of into the establishment, maybe reassured by the establishment, and maybe that's what you're seeing reflected in all the voters coming out for Biden?
No, I think it's very fair. People know 4 more years of Donald Trump could be devastating for this country. Yeah. Your last segment on coronavirus alone explained that. So people, that's why the votes have been all over the board in these primaries. And people are like, what's the best way to make sure Donald Trump is not president? But the second component isn't you can't just run against Donald Trump because he's bad. You have to have a candidate who appeals to enough new voters so that we win. What cost us in Wisconsin in 2016 was a 250,000 Democratic voter drop-off because they weren't inspired enough to come out and vote. You can't have that happen again in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and many other parts. So I just think when I look at how Bernie Sanders ran in Wisconsin in 2016, he took 71 out of 72 counties. He got 73% of young voters, 72% of independent voters, a majority of women. I mean, this is a person who really could appeal in a place like Wisconsin, and we have to win Wisconsin in order to make sure Donald Trump's not president this year.
It is a very important state. We'll be keeping an eye on it. Congressman Pocan, thanks so much for your time tonight.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Democratic voters in six states will have their chance to weigh in this Tuesday, but the battle in Michigan could be decisive. I'll talk to a former governor of that state next. A warning to my Democratic friends. You may find what I'm about to say triggering. I want to take you back to December 2016 when all the autopsies of Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump were being performed. Take a look at this headline from Politico. How Clinton lost Michigan and blew the election. Now, this bit from a DNC consultant who couldn't believe Clinton's campaign had made the decision to essentially ignore the state says it all. They believed they were more experienced, which they were. They believed they were smarter, which they weren't. They believed they had better information, which they didn't. Well, what a difference 4 years make. The top two Democratic candidates are trying to course correct from Clinton's big miss there. That primary is Tuesday, the biggest prize of six states that will be voting with 125 delegates at stake. Joe Biden has already gotten some key endorsements from top Michigan Democrats, including the governor and former governor. Sanders needs a win in Michigan to boost his momentum, and he knows it. He canceled an appearance in Mississippi to spend more time there ahead of the primary. So who's poised to take the important state this time? Joining me now to discuss is former Michigan Governor Jen Granholm. Governor Granholm has endorsed Joe Biden ahead of the state's primary. Governor, just how much PTSD do you think Democrats are still suffering from 2016 over Michigan?
That is, I mean, truly, it is Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. We are still freaked out about having lost them. We should not lose them. We should not lose them in 2020. And that's why I think there's an awful lot of effort being put into making sure those are back in the win column for Democrats.
Yeah, and I know the auto industry is obviously a big factor in Michigan politics. Biden takes credit for helping to save the auto industry.
And he should.
Is it all going to come down to that?
Well, it certainly is something that Michigan remembers. So I was governor during the bankruptcy and during the Great Recession, the bankruptcies in the auto industry, which were preceded by bankruptcies in the supplier. So at the time when the Obama administration came into office, our unemployment rate in Michigan was about 15% because we were right in the thick of those that auto meltdown. And there was a question inside the Obama administration about whether they should just allow the auto companies to go bankrupt, like Mitt Romney had said. And it was Joe Biden, the guy who understood that there was a million manufacturing jobs, not just in Michigan, but in the industrial Midwest that were at risk. He was our advocate and our ally. He went to bat, and it was so much credit and gratitude to him for intervening. Obviously, Obama himself was predisposed to save those jobs, but really, Joe Biden was a huge, huge advocate. And can I, let me just say one other thing, Essie, is that after that happened, then he was in charge of the Recovery Act. And during the Recovery Act, again, he made sure that Michigan got exactly what we needed to be able to help people as we were transitioning through this horrible bankruptcy. So hundreds of millions of dollars he made sure got to Michigan to make sure people could stay on health care. He gave us $1 billion from the Recovery Act so that we could diversify from the internal combustion engine automobile to the electric vehicle. I mean, he did so much for us during the Recovery Act. And then, just quickly, he had one more act that he did, which is when Detroit went into bankruptcy, not just the autos, but the city of Detroit went into bankruptcy. He rallied the federal government to create a Detroit task force that was able to attack blight and busing and lighting. I'm telling you, people remember in Michigan that Joe Biden stood up for us when we were on our knees. He put us on his shoulders and he carried us through that recovery.
Well, yeah, and we'll see if that all pays off on Tuesday. But, you know, on the flip side, Bernie Sanders won Michigan in the last primary. Does that make it his to lose again?
Well, I mean, certainly nothing can be taken for granted. I know there was a poll out this week that had Joe Biden 7 points up, but I don't think anybody can rely on any polling because nobody saw Bernie Sanders win coming either, or Donald Trump's for that matter, in Michigan. So clearly there has to be a lot of work on the ground. And Bernie Sanders is, you know, he's on the attack. I understand that. You got to make whatever differentiations you can. But as we have been saying throughout this campaign, is people know Joe Biden. Michigan knows Joe Biden. Whatever tax can be levied, they know that he stands with working people in the state of Michigan, and that is super important for us.
You know, I lived in Michigan when I was younger, so I'm familiar with the contours of the state.
What?
I did. I know.
I didn't know that.
I did.
Where were you?
I was in West Bloomfield in Oakland County.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, Hillary did real well in those affluent, well-educated counties like Oakland and Washtenaw. But obviously, in the more rural parts of the state, i.e. most of the state, Trump really trounced her. And the final results were very close. He won Michigan, as you know, by just 2.2%.
Yeah.
Does Trump still have the advantage there?
Well, this is what I would say. In the general election, you are right to point out that there was not an aggressive rural strategy. It's interesting because Obama had a rural strategy, and he won about 28% of the rural vote. And Hillary Clinton chose to double down on getting out the base, and she only won about 22% of the rural vote. And that difference, I mean, in Michigan, she lost by only 10,700 votes.
Right.
That's just such a tiny percentage.
Yes.
Now, granted, she got some help from the Russians. You know, he got some help from the Russians. There were all sorts of other voter suppression activities happening inside the city of Detroit. But the bottom line is, you have to go and make the case to people in every county to let them know you see them, that you are on their side. And Joe Biden is doing that, and that's very exciting.
Well, Governor, thanks so much for joining me. We'll be watching your home state on Tuesday, along with you, I'm sure. All right, Elizabeth Warren's exit from the race has brought up cries of sexism in presidential elections. That's next. In the red file tonight, with two men leading the field for president, women will have to wait at least another 4 years to see a woman become president. For some, the reason Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, and Kamala Harris did not succeed in their quest for the nomination is clear. It's their lady parts. Sexism is the reason they were kept from the prize. Take a look at this rash of headlines. Indeed, both Warren and Harris acknowledged that, for them, sexism was a factor.
Gender in this race, you know, that is the trap question for every woman. If you say, yeah, there was sexism in this race, everyone says, whiner. And if you say, no, there was no sexism, about a bazillion women think, what planet do you live on?
The reality is that there is still a lot of work to be done to make it very clear that women are exceptionally qualified and capable of being the commander-in-chief of the United States of America.
Klobuchar, though, was far less willing to hang her loss on her gender. Here's what she had to say in an exit interview with the New York Times. Let's start with the obvious. Biden and Bernie had run for president before, and they were the most well-known. I'm not saying that they weren't deserving of this, but those were the facts. So I just don't see it as an indictment of women candidates. I've often stepped back and wondered, well, is it? Were they looking for a man to run against Donald Trump? Maybe in another election. I don't know. Now, polls show a majority of Americans are, in fact, comfortable with a woman president, 71%, according to a USA Today Ipsos poll from January. And there's this, a CNN poll from January found that 89% of men believe a woman can win the presidency. Oddly, 79% of women were on the same page. So what are we talking about here? Sexism from where? Remember, this was a Democratic primary, so I guess we're implicating Democratic voters for any gender biases that played on. Or is it something else? Let's discuss it with Patty Solis Doyle, former Hillary Clinton campaign manager, plus Erin Gloria Ryan, host of Crooked Media's Hysteria podcast. Erin, good to see you. You will not be surprised to learn I did not find Warren's campaign appealing. I didn't like being repeatedly scolded. I know. I didn't like being repeatedly scolded and told that, like, unless I see things her way, I'm probably a terrible, no good person. And look, I feel similarly about Sanders, all caps style. Can that just be a preference and not sexism?
Your description of why you didn't connect with Warren is a totally understandable reason to not support her. But I think that it would be naive for people to pretend that we are not actually a country where sexism is a factor in the way that we treat female candidates. I mean, to say that it was the only factor is a little bit oversimplifying, but to say that it wasn't a factor is, I think, also naive in its own way.
No, Patty, as I said, the implication here is that Democratic voters are sexist. Do you believe that's the case?
Well, look, when Elizabeth Warren dropped out, I asked myself, I actually tweeted, I said, hey, America, what does it take for a woman to actually get elected president?
Yeah.
You know, be smarter, work harder, be tougher, be better prepared, you know, have a be more qualified, have a proven track record. Well, you know, check, 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 and check. Over the last couple of cycles, or several cycles, actually, various women have run against various men and have done all of the above, but they've lost in various degrees. Mm-hmm. And you have to ask yourself, why? And I agree with Aaron, you know, it's not the only reason, but I do think that we are being naive if sexism doesn't play a role in each of those losses.
Well, Aaron, is it a generational thing? I'm thinking about the Chris Matthews-Elizabeth Warren interview where he questioned her belief in a woman, accusing Mike Bloomberg of telling her to end her pregnancy. I don't think a man in his 30s would have put her on the spot for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that it is partly a generational thing. I think that I see millennial men are a lot more open-minded about having a female boss or having a female president. But one thing that I thought was really interesting about the way that people talked about this election was people were concerned about Elizabeth Warren's electability, which is a kind of backdoor way to say, I am fine with a woman president. I just think my neighbor might not be fine with a woman president. So it's like, I feel like a lot of the sexism was outsourced to the invisible sexist neighbor in this case. And we'll never know the full extent of how that all played into why she didn't have a more successful candidacy, why Amy Klobuchar didn't have a more successful candidacy. Yeah. But I think it's just a new version of the same old thing.
Well, because, yeah, I mean, concerns about Warren's electability could be concerns about her ideological far-leftness. You know, we just don't know. But, Patty, there's going to be immense pressure on Biden or Sanders to put a woman on their ticket. Will that be seen as genuine or kind of like a consolation prize for women?
Well, first of all, I think it will be seen as practical, honestly. You know, white suburban women are going to be very key in the 2020 election. It's what won Democrats back the House. We did very well with the Senate. So I think it's going to be a very practical decision to put a woman on the ticket. And honestly, that may be the way that we actually get a woman president, is to make, you know, have her be vice president first and then let her work her way up from there.
Aaron, before I let you go, I just have to girl detective this with you. Bill Clinton, in a new documentary, says his affair with Monica Lewinsky helped ease his anxiety. Now, was that a good thing to say or a bad thing to say? And be specific.
Oh, man. I don't like that guy. That was a terrible thing to say. It's never, like, taking advantage of somebody who you have an immense amount of power over is a terrible thing to do. I don't care how anxious you are. You're the president. Be better. That's all I have to say about that.
We can unite a bridge. I don't like that guy either. Okay, Patty, Aaron.
I concur.
Thanks so much. Yeah, all right. The three of us united. We don't like that guy. All right.
We did it.
Thanks, guys. All right. Sanders likes to slam the media. Biden has largely avoided it. Will that all change now that they are the last men standing? The two Democratic presidential candidates are known to have a bad case of allergies to the media. Joe Biden has mostly avoided all but friendly interviews. Bernie Sanders has been vocal about his disdain for the corporate media. He's also been known to lose his temper when asked questions he doesn't like. But the day after his disappointing Super Tuesday, a cheerful Sanders greeted Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, a network he and his allies have long complained about. His campaign is reportedly in final talks to appear in a town hall on that network. He's also doing a Fox News town hall. The senator has already also appeared in three town halls on CNN, and he'll be on with R. Jake Tapper on Sunday. As for Biden, he sat down with CBS and the Today Show this week. So now that it's a two-man race, will Sanders and Biden change their media approaches? With me now is CNN's chief media correspondent, host of Reliable Sources, Brian Stelter. So Sanders' campaign manager once called MSNBC's coverage terrible. Is this decision to go on MSNBC now born out of necessity.
I do think he's seeking votes wherever he can, given how strong Biden is performing.
Yeah.
And he knows he needs to reach the MSNBC audience.
Sure.
But to your point, also doing a Fox News town hall on Monday.
Yes.
Right before the next Super Tuesday contest. Really interesting.
Uh-huh.
What all of this shows is that earned media is beating free media, is beating a paid media.
Right.
Earned media means CNN. It means news coverage of your campaign because it's newsworthy.
Mm-hmm.
Bloomberg went the other way. He went with paid media. He was buying $500 million in ads. You know, a week ago, Bloomberg was all we could talk about. You know, Bloomberg was on the cover of New York Magazine. He was everywhere.
Yeah.
It's amazing how fast time is flying. But it does speak to how paid media has not been as effective as earned media in this election.
Well, and Sanders hasn't been unavailable to the press. He does a lot of interviews in town halls. Biden, the other end of the spectrum.
He's more careful. He's been more careful.
He's very careful. Yeah. And it feels, I mean, even today he was at a rally and I think spoke for a total of 7 minutes.
Right.
I sort of think of him as like the George Costanza of the campaign, like leave him on a high note, go in, make a joke, get the crowd applause and then leave before he can say anything.
Why? Because he's avoiding doing anything that's going to be a gaffe. Is that the idea?
It seems that way. Yeah. I mean, he's been real reluctant to face the media. Does that change?
And yet at this rally in St. Louis, he had thousands and thousands of people. He had huge crowds at this event. So perhaps that speaks for itself. Perhaps that's what the campaign views is what's winning and what's working. But I think these questions about both Sanders and Biden and about their performance, about their age, they're only going to increase. You know, the headline at Politico today is about the dementia election, talking about Biden, Sanders, and Trump. These are awkward, sensitive things to talk about, but it's getting louder and louder.
It is.
And by the way, it's getting used against the Democrats by voices on Fox News at the same time.
That's right. And Bernie supporters, I have seen a lot of Bernie supporters going after Biden.
After Biden.
Mental health.
But again, all three of these contenders, they're all in their 70s.
Trump is notoriously and outrageously attacked the press. He's severely limited press access to the White House. As you know, he's suing a number of networks. We don't want a repeat of that, obviously. Who is the better candidate for president where press freedom is concerned, in your view, just watching the media and watching these guys interact with the media?
Bernie Sanders has come out with a plan trying to support local journalism that's been starving and struggling. Yeah. On the other hand, he also attacks what he calls the corporate media.
Yes.
And earlier this week, he said, don't believe what you read in the media. He
sounds
views
familiar.
The media as a foil in the same way Trump does. And he taps into that same kind of anger against institutions that Trump does.
Yeah.
Biden, much more of a stay the course, normalcy sort of thing. I think what we'd see with Biden is the same thing we saw with Obama. We'd see the restoration of press briefings and things like that. Would Sanders restore press briefings? Would he make these other steps to kind of turn back what Trump was doing and go back to what we would consider normal pre-Trump? I don't know. I think those are good questions for him.
Well, we'll be watching it all. It'll be interesting to see if either of those candidates really change their tactics now that they're the last men standing.
And how it's all affected by coronavirus and what they do differently because of this thing that is surrounding all of us.
Yeah. It really is.
It affects every story.
It could be a game changer. It could be. Could be the game changer of this election. Brian, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks.
Make sure to tune in to Brian's show tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern on Reliable Sources. He'll have all the latest headlines on the news that matters, including, coronavirus. Facts are so important, so don't miss that. You'll also want to check out CNN's new podcast. Join Dr. Sanjay Gupta for Coronavirus, Fact versus Fiction. Listen wherever you get your favorite podcasts. All right, that's it for me. CNN Newsroom is up next. Stick around.